Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States v. Captain Colin R. Kovitz, number ACM 40193. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge erred by denying challenges for cause against multiple panel members. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes, please.
Very well. Appellant's counsel, you may proceed.
Senior Judge Key, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry, along with Major Matthew Blythe. We represent the appellant, Captain Colin Kovitz. As the CAF has stated, the right to an impartial panel lies at the very heart of due process. This right must be protected, especially in an environment where the prosecutorial authority chooses the members, peremptory challenges are limited, and unlike any other jurisdiction in the country, a defendant can be convicted by non-unanimous vote. Yet in this case, over one-third of the members sitting in judgment of Captain Kovitz had personal connections to the very subjects, places, and people under scrutiny. In this domestic violence case, the public would see as unfair a panel composed of the brother of a domestic violence survivor who had personally rented a room from appellant in appellant's house, the house that was the alleged crime scene while the alleged victim was living there. Another member who had a 5-year relationship with a key government witness and the lover of the alleged victim, who expressed his opinion that the key government witness was an incredible person, who had a long conversation with the key government witness just 3 days before the court-martial, and who relied on the key government witness for personal advice and personal financial advice. And another member who was the husband of a domestic violence survivor, whose survivor wife was currently pursuing training in domestic violence that had made her realize the impact of her past domestic abuse and would require her to volunteer in a domestic violence shelter, who thought of and reflected on his wife's victimization via domestic violence when he read the charges against appellant, and then went home and talked to his wife about the case, the charges, and about domestic violence. Both individually and collectively, the composition of the panel in this case creates too high a risk the public will perceive that appellant was given something less than a fair trial. I will talk about each of the three members who sat individually and the factors that should have resulted in each member's removal. And then, time permitting, I'd like to talk about the issue of viewing the panel as a collective and the cumulative impact of having multiple members with similar challenges against them sit on the panel together. So the first member is Lieutenant Colonel KB, the one who lived in appellant's house. But the first grounds against him was that his sister was a victim of domestic violence. And there are three main factors we'd highlight here. First, that his sister, she had been abused by an intimate partner, her husband, Lieutenant Colonel KB's brother-in-law, mirroring the allegations in this case. The abuse had occurred relatively recently, and maybe most significantly, the abuse had caused a family split. It had caused Lieutenant Colonel KB's divorce from, his sister's divorce from his brother-in-law. And the second grounds is that he had rented the room from appellant in appellant's house. Implied bias is about perception, and when one hears that a panel member lived in the crime scene as part of a contractual business relationship with the accused while the victim was also living there, that creates perception problems. And even within the record, we would submit that this can be seen during a prior challenge against another member. The judge cut off the defense counsel and he said, is this the member who rented the Airbnb? That's record at 207. So it's pretty clear even before the challenge is made, it's on the judge's mind. And then later, in a perhaps a candid moment, the judge directly stated on the record that his primary concern with Lieutenant Colonel KB was that the rental had occurred. That's record at 213 and 214. So we would submit that This unique connection to the facts of the case creates a perception problem.
Counsel, if I could, is it your position here today then that just the mere fact that the rental occurred was enough for the military judge in this case to find implied bias?
Your Honor, we think that would have been individually
Or is it based on additional factors of that would have been presented at during voir dire as to what the knowledge was, what the rental, you know, consisted of, how much he was in the house, those type of, you know, specific factual details that occurred during his rental of the house as opposed to just the mere fact that he rented the house?
Yes, sir.
Or rented a room in the house, excuse me.
Yes, sir. With respect to his time in the house, we feel the record is sufficiently developed. We did take issue with the military judge formulating and articulating certain questions, but not getting the answers to those questions. But we feel the record was sufficiently developed with respect to that. But we would highlight that the house was a significant focus of the litigation. So that is a unique factor that may not be present in other cases. But in this case, the mechanics of the incident were important. The case involved multiple assault allegations that happened in progression throughout the home and specifically involved interactions with the fixtures and furnishings in the home. And that was discussed during challenges. So that was before the military judge. With respect to we did all argue in the alternative that the military judge failed to develop the record, but the reality is the record was more than sufficient to rule on this challenge and to require excusal of this member. No additional questioning was required to establish that this member, the brother of a domestic violence survivor who had lived in the crime scene, should have been excused. But the real reason we take issue with the military judge's failure to conduct further questioning is not because further questioning was required, but because of the specific facts of this case, the military judge specifically listed three questions that, according to the military judge, may have revealed bias on the part of the member. However, despite identifying and even articulating these three specific questions and specifically saying that the answers would impact his decision, he made no effort to find out the answers. So we don't think the military judge should be that passive in the voir dire process.
Well, you mentioned the military judge a few times. It's the appellant's burden at trial, right, to develop the grounds for cause?
It is the burden of the party making
and
the challenge.
Is it your opinion, or are you arguing today that the trial defense counsel did enough?
Yes, Your Honor. We think the trial defense counsel did enough, and the record was more than sufficient to require excusal as it was.
I noted, I guess, in the record that I didn't see where trial defense counsel had requested or asked the military judge to bring in Lieutenant Colonel KB and do any further questions, even though there were questions raised of, you know, we didn't get answers to these questions, but I'm still finding the way that I'm going to find.
Right. Well,
it didn't get brought up at any later point either. You know, whether there was a need or a request to, you know, get specific answers to the questions that were kind of laid out by the military judge.
Right. Well, Your Honor, in Clay, the CAF said that the trial judiciary has the primary responsibility of protecting the panel from the appearance of bias. And it is true, as Your Honor pointed out, that the party making the challenge also has the burden.
Let me follow up on Judge Anixed's kind of question there. One of the real strengths of your brief is the number of times that the issue of the layout came into play. But it also may hurt you in the sense of when all of this stuff comes out, did trial defense counsel have an obligation or a duty to raise this as an issue as it kept coming out, particularly after Captain Kovitz's testimony? But it's, in my view, the layout does kind of become very interesting now based on the victim's testimony and his testimony. Should they have raised the issue again with the military judge about KB's presence on the panel?
Well, Your Honor, a challenge can occur at any time. It could be raised again. But I don't know that was new information I suppose it was newly before the court.
Well, it was new information in the sense of when trial defense counsel articulated the importance of what KB's test or what the testimony could be, which trial counsel essentially conceded. I think that's where the importance comes out, because now the military judge has had an opportunity to hear what the testimony actually is versus what was going to be proffered.
Right. Well, Your Honor, I mean, I think the standard course or the standard procedure is to kind of forecast issues during challenges sufficiently to inform a ruling. And I think the defense did that here. I don't think the defense has an obligation when those issues that were flagged and were brought up during challenges later come out on the record. I don't think the defense has an obligation to circle back and repeat the challenge that was already made. But we think that defense articulated before the challenge that the layout of the house, the acoustics of the house would be at issue, and that's exactly what happened. And in particular, I mean, two members asked questions about the house. While sitting on the panel with them, there's this member who lived in the house. And we would contend that even within the record, the fact that that degree of specialized knowledge of a crime scene on the part of a panel member is inappropriate can be seen in this case, as in every case, the military judge's very first instructions to the panel included, do not research the crime scene. And that's a record at 36. And yet we have a panel member who lived in the crime scene. So it's hard to reconcile those two. Your Honor, we would submit that it's almost obvious. If you live in a house, you will be familiar with the layout of the house. So I think the testimony was he lived there for about a week. We don't think any more questioning was required in terms of his memory of living there. Most people in the position of having lived in a specific house, when they hear evidence about that very house, would draw on their personal experience living there. And we think the record is sufficient to develop that, and frankly, more than sufficient to have made this a pretty obvious challenge, or pretty obviously meritorious challenge. Oh, yes, sir, I apologize. With respect to Lieutenant Colonel KB, we also raise in our brief some issues with the accuracy and sufficiency of the military judge's ruling. And if the court agrees, then that goes to deference. Regardless of the level of deference applied, this court should find that denial of the challenge was error. The two bases for challenge against Lieutenant Colonel KB, both individually and even more so collectively, create an appearance of bias. The next member is Major MP, and the grounds of challenge was that he knew a key government witness, Major RW. And there's three main factors we would highlight here: the nature of the relationship, and specifically the personal component of the relationship, that it was a relationship of trust, with Major MP specifically stating that he went to Major RW for personal advice and personal financial advice, and the significance of the witness and the degree of scrutiny the witness was under at trial. With respect to the nature of the relationship, the military judge found it was purely professional and just a professional relationship. These findings of fact are clearly erroneous. Major MP, when asked about the nature of the interactions, he replied, personal advice. He talked about their shared interest in hobbies, toys, and cars, And he specifically said that he went to Major R.W. for personal financial advice. This is important partially because it goes to deference, but also because of the nature of the relationship, and specifically a personal component to the relationship is an important factor when evaluating a member's knowledge of a witness. Case law talks about truly, purely professional relationships being largely okay. Both sides cited to Napoleon, where the CAF pointed out that the relationship between an O6 and an OSI agent was not social, but purely professional. But that's not the case here. This is not like Napoleon, where you have an O6 and an OSI agent who presumably is much lower ranking. This is a peer-to-peer relationship that clearly has a personal component. And turning to the second factor, this is a relationship of personal trust. In a relatively short voir dire, Major MP not only described Major RW as an incredible person, but twice stated that he looked to Major RW for personal advice, and specifically highlighted that he went to Major RW for personal financial advice. Even in the context of a truly, strictly professional relationship, the component of trust has been found particularly problematic between a member and a witness. We cited in our reply to United States v. Leonard, where the officer member knew an enlisted witness. And while the relationship there was only professional, CAF nevertheless found reversal was warranted because the member relied on the witness to prepare his gear. And as such, CAF said that the relationship must have been one of trust and reversed. In Leonard, the CAF implied trust. But here, there is no need to imply because it's directly stated. Major MP directly states that he goes to Major RW for personal advice and personal financial advice. So when comparing this case to Leonard, not only is the relationship much closer, but the degree of trust is much more direct. This is not a situation where one service member relies on another by nature of their respective jobs. This is a situation where Major MP specifically looks to Major RW for personal advice because he has trust in Major RW and he has trust in Major RW's judgment and advice. And then finally, Major RW, in terms of importance and scrutiny, that also cuts in favor of excusal. He's an outcry witness. He's closely aligned with the victim. He's dating the victim. The trial counsel acknowledged during challenges that Major RW is a key witness. And as can be seen by the defense closing arguments, Major RW's actions were under heavy scrutiny. And really, the defense closing here highlights exactly the problem, the perception problem, that needs to be prevented or here remedied. Defense counsel says, Major RW has exercised breathtaking bad judgments. It's almost shocking how bad Major RW's judgment is. It defies reason why Major RW would continue in that relationship. And who is the defense counsel making these arguments to? It's Major MP, who thinks Major RW is an incredible person, who just days before had a long conversation with him, and who goes to him and relies on him personally for advice. So when talking about perception, I mean, what perception does that create? So we would submit that this challenge should have been granted as well.
So obviously what came out during closing argument, the judge wouldn't have been privy to that when deciding on the challenge for cause during voir dire. Is there some degree of harmlessness analysis that we engage in? I mean, do we look and see what happened later on in the trial by virtue of somebody being erroneously sat on the panel, or is it just that because the challenge for cause was arguably improperly denied, that is all the error we need? I guess what I'm asking is, do we focus our analysis on what happened solely during voir dire and what the military judge knew then, or do we consider what happened later on during the court-martial?
Your Honor, with respect to a prejudice analysis, we think case law is pretty clear that's not required. In cases like Rogers, Woods, and Peters, CAF set aside without a prejudice analysis. But with respect to what's before the military judge at the time of making the decision, it was clear at the time of making the decision that Major RW was a key witness. And the defense had pointed out his relationship with the victim. They were dating or in a romantic relationship, and had portrayed him as a key witness during challenges. And the judge turned to the government and said, do you agree Major R.W. is a key witness? And the government agrees. So it's very clear at the time of the challenge and at the time of the ruling that this is a key witness. I wouldn't call that a prejudice analysis, but the level of scrutiny the witness is under, I think that is a factor in the totality of the circumstances. For example, in Napoleon, the OSI agent, Calf, pointed out the OSI agent's actions were not under scrutiny. I think he had testified about a consent search, and it may have said there was no cross-examination. So that's very different from this case, where the witness is, his actions are under scrutiny, is a key witness. And that was clear at the time of the challenge and the time of the ruling. Turning to the third member, Captain GL, the grounds against him stem from the fact that his wife was a victim of domestic violence, who is currently studying domestic violence. The underlying facts of Captain GL's wife's abuse are pretty unremarkable by themselves, but what does pose a problem are the recent developments in his wife's life and in their life as a couple that brought the subject of domestic violence to the fore. In particular, Captain GL's answers that directly link his wife's abuse and his wife's studies on the topic of abuse to appellant's case. And without repeating everything from the brief, the public would not view favorably that this member thought about and reflected on his wife's victimization via domestic violence when he read the charges against appellant. The public would not perceive as fair that this member's thoughts, when he read the charges he would be called upon to judge, were on his loved one, and specifically on the abuse that she had suffered. And this perception is exacerbated by what happened later that same day when Captain GL goes home between the first and second days of court and talks to his wife about the case, about the charges, and about domestic violence. With respect to deference, once again, there's some issues with the military judge's ruling. Absent questions from the court, I'll largely rest on our brief there. But I do want to address the government's contention in their brief that the military judge's statement that he had considered all information was sufficient to warrant full deference. This court should clarify in his opinion that a statement by the military judge that the military judge considered all information is an insufficient analysis to warrant full deference. We've cited case law to that effect in our brief, but it appears there's some confusion on the point, so this court should clearly address it for the benefit of military judges and military justice practitioners.
Before you run out of time, Counselor, I could accelerate your argument to the issue about the totality of the circumstances with respect to the panel as a whole.
Your Honor, we've contended that the composition of the panel as a collective, the cumulative composition of the panel, is a proper factor in the totality of the circumstances test. And there's persuasive case law from the Army Court to that effect. But as far as either side could find, this court has not directly addressed the issue. And while the Army Court based its decision off of CAF precedent, it does not seem like CAF has directly addressed this issue either. So we would ask that this court settle the issue by directly stating whether composition of the panel as a collective is a proper factor in the totality of the circumstances test. This is an important issue to address. And this case is a good one to address it, because this case involves not just one member, but three, and because all three members had similar grounds for challenge against them in terms of relationships between the members and aspects of the litigation.
What would the standard of review be for that? Would it be us conducting a de novo review, or would we be asking whether the judge abused his discretion by not sua sponte, I guess, disempaneling the panel at some point in time?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be the same as the standard of review for the challenges individually. And the cumulative composition of the panel would be one factor that a fully informed member of the public would be aware of and would consider. So with respect to actual bias, it would be abuse of discretion, and with respect to implied bias, it would be something less. Pending any further questions from the court, I'll reserve my brief remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Appellee's counsel, you may proceed.
Senior Judge Key, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major John Patera, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. This court should find no error in the military judge denying the actual bias challenge against Captain GL. The military judge was in the best position to observe the member's demeanor, assess his credibility, and find that no actual bias existed. Similarly, that justifies great deference, as our Superior Court has repeatedly held. This court should also provide appropriate deference to the military judge's denial of appellant's implied bias challenges against Lieutenant Colonel KB, Major MP, and once again, Captain GL. That's because in each instance, the military judge considered the evidence that was developed during voir dire and properly before him, placed his analysis using the objective test for implied bias challenges on the record, and recognized, the liberal grant mandate and his duty to apply it in close cases. But these were not close cases, and examining the defense challenges individually reinforces that point.
Counsel, on that point, you know, looking at Lieutenant Colonel KB's and the military judge's analysis on that charge, it appears, you know, at least on the record, that there were at least three areas that the military judge highlighted I could have used some more information on, i.e. that really Lieutenant Colonel KB was not asked any other questions other than the fact that he had rented a place. Didn't ask him how long he spent there a day, didn't ask him what other areas of the house that he would have visited, didn't ask him about his memory about those areas of the house. Is it your position today that the military judge did enough to develop the record on this in order to be given deference in the conclusion that was ultimately reached, that there was no implied bias?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the government's position. As was noted in the court's questioning of opposing counsel, the ultimate burden for establishing the grounds for challenge rests with the party raising the challenge. It's RCM 912F3. Plain as day in the plain language of the rule. Adding to that, in this case, the military judge had no specific information about the general layout of the home, how it would apply to the cases that would unfold. And because of that, after General voir dire, when trial defense counsel made it known to the military judge that they would like to inquire and into this particular Airbnb rental that occurred a little over 2.5 years before the court-martial, the military judge gave trial defense counsel permission, but importantly, he also informed and telegraphed for counsel that counsel will be responsible for developing the record. I believe that's on page 73 of the 67 of the record. Nope, 70, excuse
so
me.
So how do you square that with the case law that's out there from our Superior Court that really talk about the trial judiciary and the military judge being the driver of ensuring that this information comes out at the end of the day?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know. I would disagree to a limited extent about the military judge being the driver. Certainly the military judge has an important role in ensuring that a fair and impartial panel sits both in appearance and
so effect. If there were questions that the military judge had when delivering the analysis on the challenge for cause, wouldn't a reasonable person looking at that say, why don't you just recall Lieutenant Colonel KB and ask these questions?
Well, Your Honor, I think the most on-point case from our superior court is United States v. Richardson that's been discussed by the parties. And the critical distinction there was not just that there were some questions that were potentially out there based upon the answers from the veneer during general and individual voir dire, but it was that the trial defense counsel in that case actually requested permission to inquire further. That's completely absent from this case. That sends a particular message to the military judge that counsel, who has the background and is in the best position to ask these questions and develop the record, did not see the need to do so. And indeed, that reasonable member of the public would be aware that when given the opportunity, and again, it was telegraphed to trial defense counsel, that he had the opportunity and was expected to lead the questioning on this, asked just one question about the Airbnb. And that was clarifying that it happened in March of 2019, so a little over 2 years before trial, not March of 2018, which there was an ambiguous answer. And so this is factually distinct from Richardson, and that trial defense counsel never asked for permission to inquire further. And again, this came up earlier in the court's questioning. The defense, after it was clear once again from the military judge that information that might be relevant to the analysis was not developed, was not properly before him, trial defense counsel didn't take that as a hint to ask for permission to voir dire the member again. And our superior court in United States v. Clay has encouraged military judges to be patient with counsel.
Is it possible that the reason they didn't do it was because they thought it was so obvious?
Your Honor, it's certainly possible. I can't divine what is in trial defense counsel's head. All I have is the appellate record, and all the military judge had was the questions before him and the evidence before him in trying to understand what was so unique about whatever potential knowledge Lieutenant Colonel KB had about his one-week stay in a rental that could make him biased against appellant in the eyes of the public, so unable to set aside whatever limited knowledge he might know about the location of a house 2 years before, roughly about a year before the crime was committed, so as to make him biased against the appellant.
But again, those answers were easily ascertainable with a few questions that unfortunately we don't know the answer for as we sit here today as to what Lieutenant Colonel KB's knowledge of the house was whatsoever.
Your Honor, you're absolutely right. The member was just in the other room and could have been recalled to answer these questions.
So I guess going back, what deference do we give a military judge who raises these questions in his own or her own analysis and essentially puts blinders up and says, I don't want to ask the questions. Is it good enough for them to just say trial defense counsel didn't prompt me, so there's no need to inquire into these areas?
Your Honor, I don't mean to suggest that there isn't some factual scenario where a military judge would not sua sponte have the duty to inquire further. Indeed, the military judge, in the absence of an implied or actual bias challenge, has the ability in extreme cases to excuse a member sua sponte. But we have additional facts in this case that might allay any concerns both for the appellate court or the military judge in the moment about what these potential other hypothetical issues might be. So Lieutenant Colonel KB did answer questions about his stay in the Airbnb rental in response to questions from Circuit Trial Counsel. And the answers that were largely developed was it was pretty low key. He didn't remember he couldn't recall the specific location of the house, only the general location of the house. He could not recognize the appellant. Even the military judge makes a note in his implied bias analysis that when specifically asked about the Airbnb rental, Lieutenant Colonel KB had to squint and kind of perceive a little bit more. But the important thing is that the thrust of the questions and the answers the thrust of the answers that Lieutenant Colonel KB gave to Circuit Trial Counsel's questions was he didn't remember much. And so when you have that factual background coupled with trial defense counsel's, whether it be intentional or otherwise, but the bottom line, not asking further questions when it is their burden, again, that sends a message about what further inquiry is necessary on the part of the military judge. And so in the absence of a request for further inquiry from the defense counsel, in the absence of facts that were so clearly justifying further inquiry, I think the military judge in this case is entitled to appropriate deference in the implied bias analysis here.
So I asked the question, what duty or obligation would defense counsel have had to raise the issue with once the evidence had been presented? What about in this case with respect to the judge? As now, if Colonel KB was, could not recall essentially some of the details of the, about the house, but once the evidence started to be presented, did the judge have an obligation or duty to come back to him and ask him, hey, just to make sure, does any of this trigger or cause you to recall some of the things about the house during your stay?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any cases, binding or otherwise, that would expressly hold that. I think it's important to remember the framing of the military judge and what he was concerned about when he heard about this Airbnb rental. He specifically asked for inputs from counsel about the layout of the house or the knowledge of the parties, namely the victim and her children, and what unique knowledge he might have that made him impartial in the case. And while the barrier was a oft-repeated fact that was mentioned in the testimony of appellant and the testimony of the victim in this case, there was still nothing developed that were so unique about the physical aspects of the case, things that this member might have reasonably learned during a one-week stay at an Airbnb rental that might cause a military judge to sua sponte reopen the inquiry of the panel member. Indeed, the physical aspects of the of this cat barrier, its size, its weight, what color it was, generally where it was positioned in the home, those things weren't in dispute. This was several acts of domestic violence that occurred near this particular barrier, and it was certainly part of the facts and circumstances that came out, but this wasn't an instance where the parties disputed the physical characteristics, as I've already said, or an instance where, say, the member was charged with assault by a dangerous weapon, and the barrier was the dangerous weapon. It was just simply a background fact, and the physical aspects of the things that we might actually expect Lieutenant Colonel KB to learn or to have known, to the extent he remembered anything, because we don't know those that information in the record, but to the extent that he could learn something, was not reasonably in dispute.
But it wasn't, just to piggyback off of that, you know, we're talking about, you know, a cat gate or a cat barrier or something in the record as it's described. But, I mean, it clearly was an issue that was on the minds of the panel, and that one of the panel members during trial asked for an aerial depiction of the layout of the residence. So, again, you know, just as defense counsel had mentioned to the military judge in their proffer or argument on the grounds for challenge, I mean, the judge was told up front that the layout of the house wasn't going to be the central issue, but it was going to be an issue in the case, and described for the military judge how, in fact, the layout of the house, the condition of the house, persons living within the house, animals and humans, and what they perceived and what his perception, you know, Lieutenant Colonel KB's perception was while being in there. I mean, the judge knew a little bit more, you know, at the point where this starts to maybe rear its head, like, oh, the layout of the house is going to be, is there an obligation on the military judge at that point to reconsider this?
Your Honor, the direct answer to your question is no, Your Honor, but the military judge.
Why is that? Is that because you don't think it had any impact on the appellant's ability to receive a fair trial, or?
Certainly, if we're talking about the implied bias test, that's what the military judge was looking at. What about the limited knowledge that Lieutenant Colonel KB might have about either the layout of the home or specific, or the parties, the victim and her children or appellant, that would make him presumed impartial as a matter of law? Here, the military judge had specifically flagged that he was looking for specific information about what knowledge that the member might have about the layout of the home or the people residing in the home that might impact that test. The first thing that the defense responds to is that the condition of the home is not going to be a central focus of the case, as Your Honor mentioned. He then discusses that there are going to be photographs admitted showing some of the aspects that we're talking about right now, so there's going to be other evidence that'll be out there. He then ruminates about things that might come into dispute, talking about how it's unclear that Lieutenant Colonel KB might know these things. Maybe he knows these things, infers that maybe he knows these things, but doesn't ask for permission to recall the member and develop the record on that point. And again, Your Honor, it is the member's burden under RCM 912 F3 to develop the record to support that challenge. And as the case proceeded, While the one member asked questions about where the barrier was located in connection with certain, and the member asked three questions, and I apologize to the court, I don't have them memorized off the top of my head. But the thrust of the questioning was essentially, as it relates to the self-defense claim, was the member near the barrier? Like, when this particular act happened, was it on this side of the barrier? When did it fall down? Did this person go do that? But it wasn't getting at the physical aspects, the things that potentially, Lieutenant Colonel KB might have information about. And again, when the military judges...
But isn't that pretty significant then? The information that KB potentially could have had? I mean, we only know what happens up until voir dire. We don't know what happened once they got into the deliberation room and potentially if Colonel KB recalled anything. That's something we just don't know. So what about the potential for him to recall stuff after the evidence had been presented and after the members have gone back for deliberation?
Your Honor, I can't speak to that because the record is ultimately silent on that point. Really, when we're talking about an implied bias challenge, the military judge is sua sponte operating to excuse members only under the most drastic circumstances. If we apply common sense and look at what reasonable inference that a human being might remember from a stay at an Airbnb for 1 week during house hunting leave 2.5 years prior, it would be tied to the physical aspects of a particular barrier, which again, Your Honor, we're not in dispute.
Well, and you pointed to, you know, rare circumstances, but we're really looking at, you know, case law that essentially says, you know, if it's a coin flip, you err on the side of excusing the member. Earlier, you made a comment regarding the military judge's statement during the findings that it wasn't a close call. I try to square that with what I read in the record, where the military judge at the beginning of the discussion says, I find troublesome, you know, this isn't an exact quote, but I find troublesome the fact that this person actually rented a room at the crime scene, and we need to talk about that more, and kind of opens up the discussion. If it's troublesome, how does 5 minutes later it become not a close call? What facts in the record support the military judge's, I would call it a change of attitude, that he didn't think it was a close call. He actually thought more stuff needed to be, you know, that the issue needed to be talked about more. What in the record changes?
Well, Your Honor, you're absolutely right that the military judge expressed concern when he informed the about the Airbnb rental and asked for specific inputs from counsel so that he could understand what unique knowledge, what aspects might be out there that could impact the implied bias challenge. And that was on the heel of the military judge previously saying, counsel, you're in the driver's seat here, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, about developing the record about this this rental. And Your Honor, what changed between expressing general concern is what was developed during individual voir dire. The member essentially conveying that it was all pretty much low key and expressing doubt. And
the only thing that I see on the record that was developed during that time frame was a proffer by trial defense counsel about how important the layout of the house was actually going to be. And while they conceded that it wasn't going to be a central issue, you know, they put on a host of reasons of why his knowledge of, you know, what this house looked like on the inside and areas that he had went to were potentially going to be important and be issues in the trial.
But again, Your Honor,
and all I saw in the military judge's analysis, I guess, was a list of questions that we still need to get answers to.
Well, Your Honor,
and then I'm trying to square that, I guess, counsel, and this is last point, with, you know, a liberal grant mandate, meaning that if there are questions as to the impartiality, we err on the side of excusing the member.
Assuming that the party challenging the member has met their burden to independently establish implied bias and get to that close call so that the liberal grant mandate applies. In this instance, the military judge has requested specific inputs from counsel and has received several proffers. He has not had a request for the member to be recalled and developed further. When the military judge again telegraphs that these things are missing.
Why do you think that is, that the member wasn't recalled? Well, the only thing that I see in the record that explains it is that the military judge had actually excused the member for the evening prior to this discussion even taking place. And I don't know that that was one of the reasons on why the member wasn't recalled, because it was going to take some time or what. I'm just wondering, is it because the answers really weren't needed to support the military judge's finding, in that we don't need the additional answers? Or is it, you know, the fact that it was going to take some time to recall this person, and everybody would sit in the courtroom presumably and wait for this person to drive back over to the courthouse to answer 5 or 10 minutes worth of questions?
Your Honor, the record's silent to the specific hypotheticals that you're posing, but I certainly don't think it's appropriate to impute an improper motive on this military judge and what questioning he might permit or not. He was very clear that counsel had the opportunity to raise questions about these things. Indeed, the military judge conducted individual voir dire of this member across 10 transcript pages. That the there may be some inconvenience with recalling the member. Again, the record silences that point, but military judges are presumed to know and follow the law. There's nothing suggesting that this particular military judge was somehow concerned about the inconvenience that might flow from recalling this member. What he did have before him was a trial defense team that was in the best position to ask the questions, to develop the record, but asked one question about the Airbnb that had nothing to do with the cat barrier, had nothing to do with the party that may be residing there. And then he had other facts, such as Lieutenant Colonel KB expressly telling Circuit Trial Counsel that while he knew that there was a wife or an ex-girlfriend, he knew that there were kids in the house, he had no interactions with them. He had interacted with appellant maybe 2 or 3 times, but not enough to form any sort of opinion about him, pro, con, or neutral. Indeed, as I mentioned earlier, he didn't even recognize appellant going into the court-martial until there was some prompting by counsel. So given those facts that are before the military judge at that moment, it would be the military judge should receive appropriate deference, having observed the member, observed his demeanor. Because again, if we're trying to figure out what was before the military judge that gave him some comfort that the member didn't remember much about the hotel room, it could have been any number of nonverbal gestures that don't show up on a trial transcript that maybe filled in those implied bias gaps for the military judge that we simply can't see here. That's why it's important to get back to the ultimate burden in this case under RCM 912 F3. The member that is challenging someone has the burden of developing the record on that point. Now, if I could move on to Captain GL. He was the individual who had the both an actual bias and an implied bias challenge. Now, for the purpose of actual bias, the military judge is entitled to an even more deferential standard, a special deference, as discussed in United States v. Hennis. So here, the military judge observed Captain GL's demeanor and found him credible when discussing his alleged violation of the military judge's instruction. He concluded that a limited and general discussion with his wife did not violate that same instruction, and that determination is supported by the record. Now, this is a somewhat unique fact pattern that there was a technical issue and the court was placed in recess in between voir dire. And then defense, when they had the opportunity to inquire about Captain GL, they actually asked him whether he talked to his wife. And quite candidly, he said yes, and that he told her that he was involved in an assault-type case. But what's important to remember is that was the extent of any concrete information that was shared by Captain GL towards his wife. What followed thereafter was rhetorical, purely rhetorical. The wife asked, what did he do? Captain GL responded, what makes you think it was a male? That's a rhetorical response not tied to the facts of this case. Then they had a generic conversation, and frankly, a defense-friendly conversation about females who can engage in domestic abuse. That was particularly tied to the facts of this case. And so given the military judge's observations of Captain GL during that exchange and him finding him credible, his determination that the basis for actual bias, namely the alleged violation of that instruction, did not exist, is supported by the record and entitled to great deference. Turning to the implied bias challenge, simply put, a reasonable member of the public would not view the facts as developed during voir dire that would make a reasonable member of the public think that the court-martial was unfair solely by virtue of Captain GL participating in the court-martial. It's important to note at the outset The basis for the implied bias challenge was his wife's victimization at the hands of her mother 15 to 17 years before this court-martial. So not only is this far away in time, but it's wholly distinct from an adult allegation of domestic violence. The member also answered quite candidly that and unequivocally that he would hold the government to its burden. He wouldn't feel like an acquittal would let his wife down. And if we're talking about the continued impact, because the member did consider his wife's victimization when he read the flyer, but he had a credible explanation for how that was natural and how we've used different cases differently and there's different facts matter, he would be willing to sit and able to sit and hear the facts impartially in this case. But we're talking about lasting impact of learning about his wife's abuse. He said it affected him as a father. He doesn't believe in corporal punishment anymore. That's untethered from the concerns in this case. And so that, coupled with, frankly, his in the context of the implied bias challenge, his openness to the self-defense theory that there are female abusers in relationships that was ultimately posited by the defense, would not cause a reasonable member of the public to have substantial doubt about the fairness, legality, or impartiality of the court-martial by virtue of Captain GL being present.
What about a reasonable member of the public's perception with respect to KB and his knowledge of the house? And I'll ask the same question with respect to MP as well.
Yes, Your Honor. So a reasonable member of the public, looking at the facts and circumstances as developed on the record, would know that over 2 years before this house became a crime scene, that Lieutenant Colonel KB rented a apartment during house hunting, rented a room during house hunting leave. He had no distinct memories of it in the sense that he couldn't provide this distinct location. He characterized it all as pretty low key, did not encounter either the victim or her children, and had limited recollection of his interactions with the appellant. That is not the kind of facts that would cause a reasonable member of the public to presume that this particular individual could not be fair and impartial towards the appellant as a matter of law. Our Superior Court's been clear that general or innocuous prior knowledge about a case, even the specific facts of the case, whether it be through the media or through commander's briefs, aren't enough to per se justify an implied bias challenge.
What about when you combine that, though, with the fact that Lieutenant Colonel KB also had this sister who was a victim of domestic violence, recent domestic violence, you know, and recently went through a divorce? You know, when you add that into the equation of living or renting a room and at the crime scene.
Your Honor, if it was limited to that fact, the government's position might be different. I'm sure the military judge's ruling could be different. But it wasn't limited to a recent domestic violence involving children. There were additional facts before the military judge that significantly blunted the fact that his sister was allegedly the victim of domestic violence. One, to the extent that this court characterizes as recent, it was 5 years before the court martial occurred. So 2016 was when the abuse occurred. Two, and I think most salient to this court's consideration, the member was unequivocal, and the military judge found him credible, and he said he was not close with his sister. And moreover, he disclaimed any continuing impact. He hadn't thought about it since he had that one conversation with his sister near in time to her divorce. He didn't think about it when he opened the flyer and looked at the nature of the charges in the case. Those are the types of facts that would quiet any concerns that a reasonable member of the public might have about Lieutenant Colonel KB's participation in the case.
But looking at them both together, they may say this person's sister's a victim of domestic violence. He's had conversations, you know, with her about it, and he rented a room and had some knowledge of, you know, this residence, which, by the way, is the crime scene in this case. Would a reasonable member of the public think that that person is a, you know, somebody that should sit on this panel?
Your Honor, you're absolutely right. That, I mean, we're looking at the totality of the circumstances for information that was developed. So a reasonable member of the public would look at those two things together. But nothing about those facts raise a substantial doubt. Not some doubt, not, oh, that's an interesting question, but a substantial doubt about this member's ability to be fair and impartial in this case. And just on one factual point there, you indicated the member of the public might know that the knowledge about the layout of the house. Again, that information was not placed before the military judge. The military judge, trial defense counsel never asked Lieutenant Colonel KB or asked for permission to inquire from Lieutenant Colonel KB what specifically he remembered about the layout of the home, what he remembered about this cat barrier, what he remembered about the condition of the home. Was it clean? Was it dirty? None of that was in the record, and it was appellant's burden at trial. And so a reasonable member of the public looking at the limited information Lieutenant Colonel KB might have about the Airbnb rental, which was remote in time, not when he didn't investigate the crime and go look at the crime scene after the fact. This was 2+ years before this otherwise innocuous home became a crime scene, coupled with some undefined abuse allegedly suffered by his sister from her husband, would not cause a reasonable member of the public to have questions. And I'll add to that, and further buttressing the military judge's finding that the member had very little information about this. When asked by trial defense counsel the one question about his sister's abuse, what, if any, injuries his sister had, Lieutenant Colonel KB couldn't answer that question. He didn't know, which reaffirms or reinforces that there was insufficient, that he didn't have much knowledge, if any, about this. So I see my time has expired.
Yeah, one additional question,
yes,
though we're over time. Appellant's counsel has suggested that we consider establishing or considering a test for looking at the panel as a whole from the totality of circumstances kind of perspective. So I was wondering what the government's position is on that.
Yes, Your Honor. So I know appellant relies on United States v. Avery, the unpublished Army case. And I can talk about the factual distinctions between that, but appellant also cites to United States v. Castillo, and all due candor to the court, at the end they do engage in something akin to a combined error analysis about the members that actually serve on the panel. Granted, it's a fairly cursory analysis. They don't find that any of the implied bias, they found no merit in the implied bias challenges, either individually or collectively, but that opinion, and that opinion hasn't been cited again since 2015. So in Canada, the court, that is out there as binding authority for this court, some sort of combined error analysis. It does pose practical questions, and Your Honor, I think you alluded to one, which a military judge has taken each implied bias challenge in turn, made particular rulings. Does that then create a burden upon the military judge later on in the court-martial to, you know, after peremptories have been exercised, after the panel's been sat, to take a look at them holistically and determine whether there was an implied bias challenge? But I think importantly, and the purpose for waiver, because, you know, for the purpose of waiver under RCM 912F4, appellant at trial never articulated for any of these challenge members how them sitting on the panel with other members created a substantial doubt about the fairness, legality, and impartiality of the panel. And so defense not articulating that as a implied bias challenge, that interrelationship between the three challenge members, would constitute waivers, is the government's position. And then looking at the factual comparisons between this case and Avery, the Army case that I referred to earlier, in that case, the panel members, four of them, had all expressed that if the member was convicted of the charged offenses, he should be punitively discharged from the service. And the members rehabilitated themselves a little bit through the questioning, but the court looked at the totality of the circumstances and said, given the kind of unanimity, that unified theme in their potential actual bias, or to a lesser extent applied bias, they had substantial doubts about the panel. Here, there's no unifying theme. We have one individual who had a sister he's not particularly close with and stayed at the rental 2.5 years prior. We've got another member, Captain GL, whose wife was a victim of childhood domestic violence. And then we've got Major MP, who was familiar with a government witness. So there's an absence of unifying theme, which makes us factually dissimilar from Avery.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appellant's counsel, may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, starting by returning briefly to the issue of viewing the panel as a collective, the government argued that may be waived, but we don't believe there's any requirement that that be a separate challenge, so much as one factor to consider in the totality of the circumstances analysis for the other challenges. And returning to Your Honor's question, in terms of the standard of review, I think I've answered incorrectly when I said the standard would be the same with respect to actual or implied bias. I don't think the cumulative composition of the panel would be relevant to actual bias. Avery talks about the panel as a whole being relevant to the totality of the circumstances and the perception of fairness. But those are implied bias tests. So I think really the cumulative impact of these three members goes to implied bias. And Avery talks about the military judge did not adequately address the cumulative impact on the perceived fairness of appellant's panel. And again, that's an implied bias analysis. I appreciate the government pointing out Castillo as well. Then very briefly, it's probably a minor factor, but with respect to the fourth member, there was a fourth member here who had significant connections to domestic violence, volunteered in a domestic violence shelter, and et cetera, Major J.R., which, I mean, the only reason we don't talk more about that member either in our brief or in the prior argument was because of the use of the peremptory challenge. We do believe that limits this court's review of the denial of that particular challenge. However, we do also think that a stated reason for the liberal grant mandate is the availability of only one peremptory challenge, and the fact that that peremptory challenge was used on a member who also had connections to the subject matter of the litigation is a factor that a fully informed member of the public would consider when viewing the other challenges. The fact that appellant no longer even had a peremptory challenge to use against any of the three remaining members, and also when viewing the panel as a whole, that there's four members on the panel with connections to aspects of the litigation, or four members who have had challenges denied, and appellant uses his only peremptory challenge on one of them. Absent questions from the court, I'll briefly conclude.
Can you cite any authority for the proposition that that the liberal grant mandate is designed to protect members' right to use a peremptory challenge, or I guess to have an effective peremptory challenge?
Your Honor, the CAF in Peters talks about the liberal grant mandate and says, this mandate stems from a longstanding recognition of certain unique elements in the military justice system, including limited peremptory rights and the manner of appointment of court-martial members that presents perils not encountered elsewhere. And that cites to, well, there's a long string of citations. So we think that the fact that you only have, the defense only has one peremptory challenge is in itself a factor, but the fact that the peremptory challenge here was used on a member that we would argue was obviously should have been excused given her extensive background with domestic violence, a fully informed member of the public is aware of how the military justice system functions. And they would be aware that appellant used his only peremptory challenge against that member. To briefly conclude where I began, the right to an impartial panel lies at the very heart of due process. There are few, if any, areas where appellate courts have more frequently or more adamantly enjoined military judges than to err on the side of protecting the integrity of the panel. Both individually and collectively, the composition of the panel in this case creates too high a risk that the public will perceive appellant was given something less than a fair trial. This court should set aside the findings and authorize a rehearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, counsel, thank you for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.